welcome back to another episode of Extra Features. Today I have a fabulous guest. This is his third time on the show, and he doesn't even know this yet because I haven't told him. What a difference. I want him to know how much I enjoy his third film, The Letters. You guys need to watch this. This thing is strong, powerful, and is going to really make you think at times about things. He introduces me to a topic I knew nothing about, never read about in Canada, nothing. So we're going to get into it. Robbie Walsh is my guest. His new film, The Letters, is just fabulous, people. So please watch it. Robbie, welcome back.
Thank you very much for having me, and thank you so much for the nice words. You're a hard man to please, and we know that.
Well, that is very true. You follow me on Twitter, so you know I'm not always happy with what I'm watching. I want to start right at the beginning. You came to our show with your first film.
Yeah.
And then you brought me a second film.
Yeah.
And then you brought me this masterpiece. Now, I want to discuss how you got from point A of being just a guy with $2 in his pocket and a film camera to this.
Well, not much has changed, but I had a little bit more than $2, but not a lot of money to make this either. You know, I know film, I know what I want, and I get it, you know.
No, but I would argue you have a depth of field that didn't exist on your first two films. You have a unique sense of where camera placement should be. So have you learned from your first two films?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, when you watch my first one, Eden, that was kind of my little baptism of fire. But how I like to talk, I don't like to say describe my filmmaking, but how I want to make film, it's almost voyeuristic, if you want. And I want you to, as the audience member, to almost feel like you're there with your film characters or with the characters on screen. Or I want to feel like you're walking with them and living with them and being in these moments with them. So trying to hone that style I've kind of learned exactly what I want to be doing now by the time I've gotten the letters done. So with Eden, it was very kind of handheld. Wasn't a great DSLR that we had. For the time, it was great. It was a 7D we were shooting on. Then with Split, I had the first Panasonic GH. I think it was a GH2, actually. We shot that on. And then with the letters, we had a Panasonic GH4, but we had all the bells and whistles. So we shot on Metabones, and we had lens adapters for the Canon lenses. And then we used a really good edit suite. And, you know, we had DaVinci Resolve then and Adobe Premiere Pro and stuff to edit the 4. We shot on 4K, 8-bit and 10-bit in some sense. So just kind of learned the hard way when you've no money.
When people normally watch this film, are they shocked by how clear it is compared to your other films? And how much lens changes? And you change your lenses a lot. I will tell you that I can see it throughout the lens changes. It's evident to me. Maybe not evident to viewers, but to me, you use it a lot to change ambiance and the look of things. What you're looking for with the lighting, I've noticed you change your lens a lot to let either more light in or less light or give yourself an older feel of a film.
Definitely wanted an older feel. I wanted it to feel with the letters because shooting in black and white, I wanted it to look like an old, almost at times I wanted to look like an old Chaplin film, one of those kind of really old black and white introduction to cinema, really, you know. And that's how I wanted the black and white to look at times. But then some of the more creative shots would have been based on some of my favorite paintings. So one of the shots of Sarah in the bath is the death of Marat, a very famous painting. Another shot of her in the bath would be based on the death of Ophelia, the lady in the water. So there's tons and tons of stuff like that. I'm rambling off here now. So, but there was a lot went into this. a lot went into it. We didn't have a lot of time again, so I did as best I could with what I had, you know.
Okay, so let's, before we get too far ahead, let's go right back to the beginning. How did you learn about this? Was this big in Ireland, this topic, or just...
It's still big. It's huge. It's getting bigger. It was kind of creeping into, slowly kind of drip feeding and creeping into the consciousness of the public. And then there was what you would call like whistleblowers, I suppose, but people who really kind of exposed the injustice of it. A couple of people in particular, like mainly like a woman called Vicky Field and another girl called Emma McMahona. And then you had women like Lorraine Walsh and Stephen Teeps spearheading the campaign, and Sharon and that. They were all slowly starting to creep into the public consciousness, and then it just hit with a bang, and people start really kind of exposing it, saying, no, you know, they were lying to us. They told us we were healthy. We found out years later that we weren't. And that's what happened, and it's continuing to happen. It says there's 221 women affected. That's 221 that's known about. And unfortunately, the scary thing is that number could grow. And as you might have seen at the end of the picture, it's cervical check isn't the only thing that was being investigated as all this is being exposed. Breast check and bowel check are two other things that are being really heavily scrutinized now because of it. You might want to tell people exactly what it's about, so they might know what I'm talking about here.
Well, it's about cancer. I mean, it's about breast cancer and women with cancer and women being lied to by somebody.
So what happened was, it's based, set against the backdrop of a thing called a cervical check scandal in Ireland. Which, just to really loosely sum it up, when women went to get their smear tests in Ireland, they were told they were being healthy, that there was no cancerous cells or signs of cancer being detected. When in actual fact, when the tests were being sent away, they were showing signs of early signs of cervical cancer. But they weren't being informed about it. They were being told, no, you're fine, you're healthy. And as the years went on, they were continually being told, no, you're okay, you're healthy, there's nothing wrong with you, when their health was declining. And then they'd be diagnosed with cervical cancer, and then they found out then that actually, in fact, 2 or 3 years previous or a year previous, you were showing signs of cervical cancer, but you just weren't told. But now you've got your affairs in order, essentially, and there's nothing more we can do. Get healthy. We can make you comfortable. They're not in all the cases. Some women have survived. Some women haven't. Some women are still fighting.
Okay, but why? You're a filmmaker. I mean, your first two films, Sweat and Eden, have nothing to do with this. Like, this is heavy topic, buddy. Like, this is totally, like, heavy. I don't know how to describe it any other way than that. Like, people will be moved by watching this film. I mean, Eden's a film, Split's a film. This is, I don't know how else to describe it. It's something very heavy to watch. Like, this is not an easy, just sit down, popcorn on a date film. Like, this thing's going to be shown forever to people.
Well, to a degree, I'll agree with you, but Eden, to me, was a very heavy topic. Because that's just continually gotten worse as well. Eden deals with homelessness. And the homeless situation in Ireland, not only in Ireland, I think worldwide, has gotten far worse. I mean, when you're hearing about what's happening in like California with homeless situation there, it's insane. It's just absolute insanity. The homeless situation has gotten out completely out of hand in Ireland, and it's going to continually get worse. We have students. The students now are protesting outside government buildings because they don't have anywhere to live while they're studying. Like, think about that. Like, you have people coming to study medicine in Trinity College, to study literature, to study economics, to study architecture. in Trinity College in UCD, leave nowhere to live. Single women walking the streets with kids in prams getting fed on plastic, the kids getting fed on plastic plates outside the GPO. And if anyone who knows Irish history, they know what the GPO is, the General Post Office, is where the Easter Rising and all their revolutions would hugely take place. And you have kids nowadays getting handed paper plates with food on it in 2021, essentially 2022. Homeless, sitting there eating their dinner off a paper plate outside of the General Post Office. So Eden really addressed that, and Eden addressed that in 2013, 2014. So, you know, the films, I don't mean to get off topic, but the films I do make do have a bit of a social conscience. But this one, I swung for the rafters on this one, like, you know.
Okay. Just so I don't look totally bad in this. Eden is more of a love story to me. I really think there was a bond between the two main characters in Eden.
Yeah.
This is not Eden to me. This is like, wake up, people. Pay attention to what's going on. And this is how it affects people. I really think with Eden, you were a beginning filmmaker. You were getting your legs. This one, you got them. Like, you were really showing us what you want to do.
Yeah. Well, yeah, with the letters, I literally wanted to slap people over the head with it, you know?
Oh, you did. You did.
No other way is to describe it. I wanted to just put it in people's faces. And there's scenes in the film where it's literally staring right at the audience saying, what are you doing?
Okay. Well, let's get neat. Now, you have a bunch of children you had to work with at the beginning of the film.
Yeah.
Did you try to make these children as annoying at the table as possible? Did you work on it? Because they drove me nuts.
So the thing with the kids is three of them are relatives of mine. And the four kids are performers. So two of them are sisters. That would be Abby. Or that would be Thea and Paige. And they act anyway. They go to stage school. They've actually been in films with Mel Gibson and all, and what's Ice Cube's young for his name? Ice Cube's son, his name's gone completely on my head.
Jackson.
I think it's Odell Jackson, is it?
Yes, Odell Jackson.
So they just recently finished a picture with him. And then my niece Abby, who plays the oldest girl, is a dancer. She's a national dancing champion. And then the other girl, Tony, is a friend of mine's daughter who is a performer as well. So when you put them all together with Mary Murray, the lead actress, who's one of Ireland's most experienced, talented actresses, you see her in everything from Peaky Blinders to Penny Dreadful, the Magdalene Sisters. She's in everything. She's a fantastic actress. She essentially became a mom, a teacher, and a psychiatrist to the four kids. But like that, with my films, I like to have huge element of improv. So I love being able to go over to the kids and say, well, Mary, your mum is over here making tea. Wreck our head. Go out your way to be as annoying and as kid-like as possible. And of course, we just kept giving them bars of chocolate and cans of Coca-Cola, and you got hyper.
So they really liked you then?
Yeah. I was the cool uncle for a couple of days, but then the mums, my aunt, my cousins who were the mums and dads of the kids would ring me going, these kids won't go to sleep, man. What do you have to do?
So why did you choose black and white? Because you wanted to bring an homage to the 50s, or just because you think you could tell your story better? I mean, I think you do. I think you definitely have to move closer to people with black and white, which you do a lot, I've noticed. You do a lot more closer up shots than you have in your other films.
Yeah.
So is that why you chose black and white? And obviously you chose three different lenses, I think, for each shot. So each story you tell, I see a different lens.
With the black and white, I really want to pay... it's really a love letter to some of my favorite films. There's also a beautiful bleakness the black and white. And you see some of the shots are really bleached out. And you really have to kind of, it really draws you in to the, to the, to the, to the character, and it makes things seem really darker and bleaker. But it's also a love letter to some of my favorite films. So A Streetcar Named Desire would be one of my favorite movies. Eight and a Half, La Dolce Vita, Dr. Strangelove, even to an extent, with the scene with the politician. So it's a huge homage. And I'm not even mentioning the likes of the Gold Rush and the really beautiful old black and white film that, that I absolutely adore. That's why I wanted it black and white. That's why we made it look, that's why I made it look the way it did. Because, yeah, it is an absolute love letter to the 40s and 50s cinema.
So why three different stories, not just one?
Each, because I think the three stories, you have to represent a different walk of life to show that this topic, cancer, affects anyone. There's no PC with it. There's no wokeness with it. There's no pick and choose. It does, cancer in general doesn't care where you come from. It doesn't care how much money you have. It doesn't care how many family members you have. You know, it's gonna, it affects you. If it gets a hold of you, it gets a hold of you. And that's why each woman is from a different walk of life. So Mary Murray's character, whose her name is Sam, with the four kids, would be from a very working class area in Dublin. And when she got sick, her big dilemma was, how do I leave my kids? What do I leave for them? I don't have much in life. How do I know they're going to be okay? With Kathleen Yates' character, Mary, she was an American who came back to Ireland, who is from a good, you know, upper middle class back, would have an upper middle class background, would say. But again, doesn't have any kids, but has her mum to look after, who has Alzheimer's. So we have to figure out how she deals with her mum, who's essentially a child in the film, you know? And then that's all the problems she has to deal with, aside from getting gripped with this horrible disease. And of course, then you have Kleena, who's Sarah Carroll, fabulous Sarah Carroll, who was a strong, single, career-driven woman. The definition of progress, we'd say. And like that, has nobody to tell, nobody to unload her problems to. Nobody to rely on or lean on to deal with all of this. So she's all alone in the world. And it didn't matter how much money they had or how little money they had. This is how it affected them. This is how it affected their daily lives. So making a sandwich became next to impossible. Trying to get the kids ready for school came next to impossible. Trying to get your mum, who was not very well, to clean herself is next to impossible, because you're fighting this huge battle yourself. Sorry, that was long-winded.
No, perfect. I love it. I want to discuss a shot you have in the film next. One of your characters, when you switched to color for the first time, which I was shocked that you were bringing color into the film. Was that supposed to shock the viewer? That's not my question. That was one of them, though.
Yeah, it's supposed to snap you.
Okay. You have a beautiful stair shot. I find you decide to set up your camera differently in this shot than you have at any other point during the film. Where are the stairs and why did you choose them?
Well, the stairs are in Freemasons Hall in Dublin. And I chose them because it's a very, very, very beautiful building. And I thought it really complemented the green dress. The green dress on Sarah, again, is a nod to atonement and Singing in the Rain. If you remember Singing in the Rain, the very famous green dress, and if you remember Atonement, Keira Knightley, the beautiful film, the beautiful green dress. And I really just thought that whole beautiful building complemented that that one shot I really wanted. So it's where I shot there, you know.
So do you just ask, do you go up to the Freemason building and say, hey, can I shoot here? Or how does that work?
Yeah, you have to be a member.
Oh, okay. I didn't know. That's why I'm asking these things. Okay, I wrote in my notes, I thought your dialogue feels real. So I asked myself, are you pulling from real events? Like, did you talk to anybody? Did you do any research? Or is this you thinking how they feel?
I'm going to have to be careful what I say here. It's inspired by real events. We did sit down and speak with people affected by this. But it is only inspired. They're all fictional stories. It draws a lot of it is drawn on different women that I would have known growing up as a kid, and seeing these kind of ways of life played out. But a lot of the stories, yeah, they would be inspired by what happened, but they are fictional. The script itself, it would be constructed improv. So we wrote a script, and I'd say to the actors, here's how I see the scene going. Here's how they speak to each other. Do your version of it and take it where it needs to go. Go where you need to go with it. And I suppose that's as close to a good answer as I can give you on that, you know.
Do you find you normally write from real life? Eden's obviously based on homelessness, which you've suggested. Split's a little bit, you must have seen something like that in Split. I mean, you shoot outside a lot, you're in parks. So do you find your writing comes from real life? Like, do you write ever fiction, or everything to you is always based in reality?
The stories are fictional, but they absolutely come from what you know and, you know, experiences. Your own personal experiences. You write what you know.
I
suppose that's the best answer I can give on that.
I'll give you some help. Do you find, where do you originate a story from inside you? You finished with the letters. Obviously, I know you're a filmmaker. You started your next project. So when do you start writing your next project? Or is it just organically happens? Or do you have a date in mind saying, oh, God, I got to start this by Monday. I got to get a page out.
I don't know. Like, with the letters, the entire film worked from that shot, that shot in the bat with Sarah. And when I'd been watching and learning more about what was happening, and I realized that at any moment it could have been someone I knew walking into me, telling me anyone could have came up to me, my sister or my mum or my niece, or someone could have came in and just said, look, I don't have much longer to go. I have to get my affairs in order. Here's what happened to me. So with that in mind, I constructed the whole film backwards. So I had this one image of the death of Venus, essentially, is what I call it. So the shot is based on the death of Ophelia, but Venus is you know, meant to be beauty incarnate. So with the shot of Sarah in the bath was where I walked back from, and I knew we wanted to build up to this dying swan moment in the film. So I construct the whole thing around that. There's no time frame, I don't think, for when you decide your next film is going to be made, or what you're going to do, or when you're going to do it. You just kind of start, and like with this, I started, and 2 years later, you know, here it is out there, you know. So, yeah, I think it's an organic thing. You know, I suppose if someone's turning around saying, look, we 5 million for you to write the next movie, you're going to set deadlines for yourself. But when you're doing it for yourself and having to raise your own money, it has to happen organically, you know.
How much research did you do in Alzheimer's before you started filming?
I done a little bit on it, but without getting into Kathleen, who plays Kathleen Warner Yates, the American actress who plays Mary in the film, had her own harrowing experiences with Alzheimer's. I personally don't want to get too into it, because if you ever speak to her, she can tell you herself. But she brought a lot of her knowledge into that role with Anne Russell. Kathleen had dealt with an incredibly similar situation, I think, with her father. So we didn't really get too much into it or tell Kathleen, here's what you have to do. It was like, look, here's the scene I imagine. How do you think that would play out? And it was a huge cooperative process with the actors. Huge. Having to ask them to go to places in their psyche that were incredibly dark and harrowing. I was never going to make them do something like that. It had to be something that was completely cooperative and consensual and something we would discuss and slowly get there. But the character of Bridget, who was played by Anne, who has Alzheimer's, that would have been ourself and Kathleen talking at great lengths to how they wanted to get that character and those situations to where they were. Essentially, I had the camera and we just caught it, you know. We just filmed until we got gold, you know.
So, at around the hour mark, you probably know, being the filmmaker, the exact time, the voice of Emma, I can't even say the...
Emma McMahona.
McMahona. See, not being Irish, there's no way I could say that. Yeah. Why did you decide to add that to your film? Because I find it's a little bit different from what we've been watching. It's just sort of in there and powerful at the same time.
It's to show that this is a real thing, to show how it's really affected people, so that, because you can it doesn't matter what you're watching on screen at times, you can desensitize yourself because you're separated by a screen. So what you're watching on camera, you're watching a movie, like for instance, you're watching Aaron Brockovich or you're watching The Big Short, and there's kind of funny moments and you can separate yourself because it's a movie and, you know, the thing comes up at the end and it says, here's what happened. And you walk away and you went, oh, I just watched Christian Bale and I just watched Julia Roberts and it was an amazing movie. Then you go back to your dinner, you know. With this, halfway through the film, I just needed to just keep reminding someone, you know, like, it's like slapping someone in the face that this happened. Listen to this. Listen to what's being said. And this is how it affected someone. So when you hear someone saying, I dreamt that I'd died and I didn't want to die, I wanted to wake up to say goodbye to my kids because I hadn't said goodbye to my kids, that's when it gets your brain thinking, holy crap, man. Even now, I can remove myself from it because I'm not facing that on a daily basis. So I'm not everyone faces their own mortality on a daily basis, but it's not in your face in the way that it has affected these people. So when you listen to that, insert right in the middle of the movie, that's somebody that has to deal facing their own mortality every minute, every day, 24 hours, 7 days a week. And that's where I needed to get across. Like, you're watching a film, but pay attention because this is real, you know? Pay attention. Wake up, you know? Sorry, getting a little bit emotional here.
Well, I think this film brings that out of everybody after watching it. If you don't have emotion, then I don't think you're watching this film.
Yeah.
Or paying attention. Now, when you're a director and you have a lot of actors on set, do you tell them what to do or do you let them more make their own choices and you're like, and then correct them, or do you try to give them direction beforehand?
It's how I like to make film. It's very much give the actors as much freedom as possible. There is as well how I make film. There's so much going on, and you become the person with so many hats on at once that you kind of forget exactly what happened from day to day when it's 2 years later. But when it came to dealing with the actors on the set, we would talk about it, we would get into it, but there's also a huge moment where you have to leave the actor to it. So you have to let the actor get into their own headspace. You can't be bogging them down with the minuscule details of, have we got the battery in the camera right? Do we need to recharge this? Do we need to have a lens cap on, or do we need to have a lens on a lens? Do you know what I mean? Or a filter on a lens? Do we need to, are we going to go with 35? Are we going to have a kit lens? What are we doing now? The actor doesn't need to hear these conversations, especially in a film like this. So what you would do is you would talk with them, you would do a take. Once everything is set up, take one, we go over. Very kind of, depending on the scene, it would be a gentle chat. How do you feel that went? Do you think you can do a bit more of this? Try doing this. And then there's times where we just say, especially if it's a talking head scene, I would just say, guys, keep talking until I say cut. And what happens then is, as you're filming, the beautiful thing about doing something like that is, as you're filming, especially when you're telling people to improv, is that the camera's going to stay on whoever's good in that scene. So the camera's going to, if you know what you're looking for, the camera's going to stay on whoever is delivering, whether they're delivering a reaction in their look, in how still and how poised they are in the scenes. Like Sarah Carroll in the film does everything by doing nothing, you know? And if you just give the actors that kind of freedom and yet you're shooting like that, you've no choice but to get whoever is good. And it's not to take away from anyone to say if someone was bad, but the camera is going to decide who's good in that moment and who isn't. You know what I mean? And it works. It works both ways. If take three, you could get the other actor becoming the new Brando or the new Meryl Streep, and you're going to get that, you know? Sorry, I hope that answered the question. I'm rambling here again.
You're doing great. Don't worry. I always pull something out of it. Okay, I want to get to the end of the film, and I'm not going to spoil it, so you're going to have to do your best. Okay. You switch to color and piano music to get your point across. Again, why do we have a switch from color and piano music added? And I definitely think you change your focus of the film, if that makes sense. I think the whole time you were showing me a certain life, and at the end, I think you kind of flip everything over, if that makes any sense.
Okay, so we'll talk about the opening now in a minute, which is, well, and I'll tell you the meaning behind the opening. But the opening and the opening and closing bookend the film.
Yes. So
the closing of the film, what I wanted to do was, it's a Wizard of Oz moment.
Okay.
The most famous thing, you know, next to the jazz thing, or the Wizard of Oz, was the introduction to color. But at the same time, what it is it's, I reconstructed some of the more famous paintings that I loved growing up, learning about it in school. I'm not saying I've studied art extensively at all, but I know what I like. And it's up to the viewer, as they're watching, they can spot them as they go. But also what I wanted to do was I wanted to show in the very last moments how these characters seen themselves but will never get to realize themselves like that. You see Mary and, or you see Kathleen and Anne as the mom and daughter looking at each other as they never will, because that's how they've always wanted to. You see Sarah lying in the bath looking like a porcelain doll.
Yes.
This, you know, she will never get to realize that side of her, in her mind, and not in her mind, in her mind. You see Sam, which is Mary Murray's character, with the four kids lying on the bed in peace, just wanting to be with her children. But that's in their last moments, that's what they see. That's their last moments, how they've seen themselves and what's been taken away from them. Not by their choice or their design. So that's how I wanted to see myself like this. I worked my life to get to this, and it's been taken from me. And this is me, my last moments, viewing myself, and I'm broadcasting it to you, and how you are seeing me, and how I wanted to see myself. Even through all the hardships you've just watched on screen, how my life really was, here's how I wanted to view myself. How we all do. how we all do. We all struggle and work and fight our own little personal battles. But I think on the inside, we imagine ourselves one day being able to sit with our feet up, or in that Garden of Eden moment almost, where everything is perfect around us, and, you know, we're happy and content. But that, essentially, for these characters, has been just whipped from them, you know?
Now, you said that book ends in the beginning. So in the beginning, we have music again and a ballerina on stage.
Yeah. So the opening of the film is my, again, love letter to one of the greatest films ever made. It's Raging Bull. Again, a black and white film. But when you see the opening of Raging Bull, it's the atypical, stereotypical view of the angry caveman. If people want to say, and it's a phrase I don't like, toxic male or toxic masculinity. I'm not a fan of that phrase, you know, but we'll use it for the time being. So if you have someone that is perfectly described as that angry, misunderstood, angry male, it's the uneducated, old school boxer that knows how to get in and doesn't know how to solve problems but with their fists and violence. And that's what Raging Bull, the opening Raging Bull, was this beautiful opening with this lone, single, angry boxer in the ring. And if you go to the complete other end of the spectrum, which is the stereotypical view of a woman, of the soft feminine woman, it's the ballerina. So what we want to do is do my love letter and my opening to love letter to Raging Bull. My opening is the ballerina, the beautiful, soft, graceful, feminine version, stereotypical version of the female form. I'm not too sure whether people are going to like me saying that or not, but that's exactly what it is. It's a love letter. It's the other end of the spectrum to the opening of one of the best films ever made, which is Raging Bull. You know.
Fair enough. Okay, I'm going to move on to fun questions so we can liven this up a bit more.
Okay.
If not, that's taken away from your film, but we got to have some fun.
All right.
Since it's Christmas time, your favorite Christmas present?
Favorite Christmas present?
Mm-hmm.
That I've ever received?
Correct.
It was old school wrestling ring and wrestlers when I was a little kid.
Are we talking like WWE with the blue ring and the WWE in the middle?
Yeah, so I'm gonna say most. I'm gonna join them all together. So when I was really young, we used to get the big rubber wrestlers, and then as I got a little bit older, which say older, I was like 10 maybe. We got the smaller little with the big body and the little heads. And then because at the time the wrestling ring was next to impossible to buy in Ireland, an uncle of mine got us this wrestling ring in Jersey my mum got him to buy it for us because he was working there. So my mum gave him the money. He came home. My mum and dad got us this wrestling ring. I think it was in Jersey. I'd have to clear that up with my dad. But it was a WCW ring, but we didn't care. Well, they were the best Christmas presents, the wrestling.
Wow. Since me and you have such a love of old film, well, who's your favorite director of all times?
I can't give you one. I mean, Scorsese, Fellini, Godard, Spielberg. I love Ben Wheatley.
Ben Wheatley comes in.
Yeah, Ben Wheatley. Ben Wheatley's a genius. Ken Loach. Wow. Ken Loach would have a huge influence in how we make film.
I absolutely agree. I can see Ken Loach in your film. Still dead about that.
Yeah. Who else would it be? Yeah, I mean, Aloy Kazan. I love his films. Yeah, Aloy Kazan.
Well, you just mentioned Streetcar Named Desire, so that kind of gives you the
On the waterfront.
Best film of all time. It's one of them.
I know, yeah. Again,
okay, your last question's really easy. Your favorite subject in school?
I don't know. Hold on, let me...
Yeah.
What was my favourite subject in school? Yeah.
Missing school.
I agree with that one. Tell everybody where they can find your amazing film.
At the moment, we're looking for cinema. We're going to be doing a rolling cinema release in Ireland that's still going in, and hopefully then we're going to have some cinema releases in North America, Canada, and then it'll go online soon enough, maybe January. But it's going to be in Pasadena now in late December, and it's going to be screened on as part of the Blow Up Art House Film Festival in Chicago from the 5th. And yeah, we'll let you guys know straight away from there where it goes.
Thank you much for your time and have a fabulous day.
Thank you very much for having me.